Welcome to Florida.
That is the voice of New York Times bestselling author and award-winning environmental reporter Craig Pittman. My name is Chad Scott, and this is Welcome to Florida. This week, a must-read for you in the Florida Phoenix. Every week, every Thursday, Craig has a new article published, FloridaPhoenix.com. This week, the governor saying something that is astonishingly dense, even by his standards.
Well, he was holding a press conference for something that, you know, it's pretty good. It's a good thing. He was saying, we're going to spend a lot of money on resilience. We're going to spend a lot of money on pumps and pipes and walls and stuff like this to fight the rising sea level. He couldn't bring himself to use the words climate change. He didn't use it. He had his new DEP secretary there. He didn't use it. He even had the new chief resilience officer. He didn't use the terms climate change. But OK, that's fine. That's fine. They're spending money on, you know, stuff that's good for the state. But then a reporter in the audience asked him, well, Governor, you're doing something about the symptoms of climate change. Are you doing anything to fight the causes of global warming? And he just kind of blew up and said that, oh, you know, well, I find that when people talk about global warming, what they really are doing is they're talking about trying to do some left wing stuff that is, you know, is stuff that they would not do anyway. And this gives them the excuse to do it. And we're not going to do any of that left-wing stuff.
Left-wing stuff.
I know. So he didn't really explain
That's a direct quote, by the way. I just want people to be clear about that.
Yeah, I'm not making that left-wing stuff. And so then he started talking about gas prices and energy independence. And it's like, so you're saying don't clamp down on fossil fuel manufacturers. Don't try and make them cut their emissions, because that's that left-wing stuff. You want to keep building, you know, more and more protections against the coastline, against the rising sea level, and not try and stop the sea from rising. That's just crazy.
So
I compared it to Andy Taylor talking about Aunt Bee's awful pickles. So,
I don't know if you've used this analogy before. I've heard it elsewhere, but, you know, climate change is a bathtub and water is nearing the top and the faucet is still on. And these arch conservatives like DeSantis and like Rick Scott and like Donald Trump want to pretend you can alleviate the water level without turning the faucet off. Turn the goddamn faucet off. That's fossil fuel production.
They want to build the tub higher. They don't want to turn the water off.
Right. Or additional pipes to alleviate it, or just let it spill out onto the floor. But heaven forbid, you know, the sacred cow of fossil fuels cannot be touched. And this is that equal sign with the dash through it. You cannot be serious about fighting climate change or mitigating climate change without ending our addiction, our century plus long addiction to fossil fuel, period.
Well, so meanwhile, though, there's this conservative movement to reject any form of, and this is their word, discrimination against the poor fossil fuel companies. Like, oh my gosh, you can't pick on poor BP for spilling oil in the Gulf of Mexico. That's just horrible. You know, that's as bad as telling black people they can't use the same water fountain that you use.
Yeah, there is a huge backlash coming against the idea that fossil fuels are incompatible with a sustainable future on this planet. That is a reality, but the money and the power and the influence wielded by the fossil fuel industry is not just going to sit back and allow all of that to slip through their grasp. And you're going to get foolishness like left-wing stuff out of our haplessly moronic governor who, like you've said before, on one hand touts his environmental record and on the other hand gives you nonsense like this.
Yeah.
FloridaPhoenix.com. Draw your own conclusions.
I should just mention, by the way, I just signed a contract to continue writing my column for another year.
Wonderful. Congratulations. So, fantastic.
Look for lots more bad puns and oddball pop culture references.
Great news as we wrap up 2021 here. And as we wrap up 2021 and I think about Florida, there are pillars of this state inside the state and as the rest of the nation and world really looks at us. And I think when people think about Florida, those images that come to mind, beaches, Disney, alligators, oranges. We have done episodes from our first episode on alligators to recent episodes on Disney and beaches in between. We close out that square, so to speak, today, Craig, with Aaron Thursby, author of Florida Oranges, A Colorful History.
people tend to send, or they used to send, oranges for Christmas. So this is sort of like a good topic for our Christmas show. What first attracted you to the topic of writing about Florida's oranges?
Well, it's two things I love: history and food. I'd already written a short form article about it, and the publisher approached me, and I ended up writing a book.
So I have to ask you, what's your favorite type of orange?
Ooh, the Satsuma. Although it's not strictly scientifically an orange, it is really, really good.
it's orange adjacent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When did oranges come to Florida?
With the Spanish. They sailed here. on a Spanish ship.
Were they brought along because they were afraid of scurvy, or were they specifically trying to start an orange crop in Florida?
Yes, they were brought along specifically because of scurvy. They didn't really call it that. They just understood that after a long sea voyage, if you got to land and then immediately ate something citrus, that whatever health problems you had would drastically improve.
How long was it before oranges became a major crop in Florida, an industry, as opposed to just, you know, maybe a grove here, a grove there?
300 years, basically. 300 years. It was they brought oranges here in the 1500s, but it was really ramping up as an industry by the 1800s. There were a few people that did in the 1700s make a business out of it, but if you talk about it as an industry, it's really the 1800s, because there were too many wars, too many conflicts, Florida changing hands too many times for it to be a viable crop. And then again, the Civil War interrupted the start of that.
Tell us about Jesse Fish, who is a very intriguing character.
He is just one of my favorite characters, because I had never heard of him before. And he's out of St. Augustine. He was just a lovable scamp who had a really intriguing life. He came here to Florida as a representative of an English company because the territory was Spanish at the time. And he ended up becoming not really a British citizen so much anymore, but a citizen of St. Augustine. And that's one of the things that I like the most about him. And also that he grew his orange groves to get away from his wife. That's the other.
But he was the first, he was the first prominent orange grower in Florida, individual orange grower.
Correct. And he exported his oranges to England, because the local market wasn't exactly, everybody had an orange grove in their backyard, basically. So you couldn't sell it to people in St. Augustine. They weren't going to buy it. They had an orange.
They had their own. Yeah.
Yeah. They had an orange tree in their backyard. What would be the point? So he managed to find a way to market his oranges to England. And it was quite the event every time his oranges made it to the dock. Word would spread and, you know, people would come to get the oranges as quickly as they possibly could before they disappeared. So he made quite a bit of money and lost quite a bit of money.
Well, now, why did he lose money? Was it because of the freezes, or was that too early for that?
Nope, not because of the freezes. He lost money because he was not a careful businessman. He was good at selling things, but he wasn't so good at keeping track of everything that was going on in his empire. He also may have done some shady dealings with the changing of hands between the Spanish and the English.
What, a Florida businessman did something shady? No way.
He could be very shady. Anybody who loves the history of Florida should look into Jesse Fish. I mean, there's a lot of legend and lore, and it's hard to separate the fact from the fiction, but gosh, the fiction is fun. The facts that we know are interesting. He was just an original, really. An English person who came here, learned Spanish early in his life, almost became indistinguishable from the people who not really were native here, but the Spanish here. They said he spoke Spanish so well, they couldn't tell that he was English. And, you know, when it came down to it, the Seven Years' War, he smuggled food. He smuggled food when there was that conflict because Florida really depended on food from, you know, the Eastern Seaboard, and all of that was English. If you have a conflict between the, you know, the British and the English, and your particular little colony in Florida is Spanish, and then you suddenly can't trade with South Carolina, I mean, that's devastating, and they nearly starved. But he smuggled.
So he saved St. Augustine, basically.
He did. He and a Scottish fellow. Oh gosh, I'm blanking on his name. But he and a Scottish fellow teamed up together. I mean, it's not like they didn't make money. They totally made money. But if they hadn't decided to basically commit treason, because that's what it was. It was treason when it comes down to it, because here he is going back to a British colony and smuggling food back to a Spanish colony, and he's a British citizen. Yeah, that's treason.
Now, let me ask you about another shady character in the early years of the Florida citrus industry. Odette Phillippe over in Safety Harbor.
He was interesting because there's not many people of color that actually make it on the board because there were so many bars against it. But in the early days, it was a little wild, wild west. So he kind of slipped in as a major grower that was also a person of color. He was a very interesting person.
Put it mildly.
Well, he lied a lot. He was a very interesting liar. He lied a lot about where he came from and who he was. So it's actually very difficult to know who he was. We know for sure that he had a plantation and it was in and around Tampa. We know for sure that before that he was a little bit further south. We know for sure that he had a cigar factory.
And he was the first to plant grapefruit, right?
You know, I kind of, throughout this process, I take everything with a grain of salt when anybody in the citrus industry says a person was the first to grow anything, I always kind of look at it askance. He was one of the first to popularize grapefruit. Mm-hmm. Whether he was the first or not, like I said, it's tough to actually...
It's as hard to prove as him claiming he was Napoleon's doctor, right?
Oh, Napoleon's doctor. He was much too young.
Yeah.
He was much too young. He did name things. He really was an admirer of Napoleon, but he was much too young to have been Napoleon's doctor. There is some speculation that he could have been a doctor on a pirate ship, that he got sort of press ganged, shanghaied more like, and was sort of pressed into service and was on a pirate ship. But again, hard to know what is and isn't true about him as a character. But as a pre-Civil War grower, he is one of the more interesting ones that we have.
I've got a question about the cultivation of oranges. And you talk about these early growers. That's, you know, 175, almost 200 years ago. One thing I didn't realize about apple orchards is how different apples are now from what they used to be. How different are the oranges we get out of Florida today from what they were 150, 200 years ago because of genetic modification or pesticides or big ag or any of the other influences turning what is, you know, a crop into an industry?
More and less than you would think. There's some varieties like Valencia that I think have pretty much been unchanged. I mean, sure, they've tinkered here and there, but the taste is going to pretty much be the same. We found something that works and we darn well stuck with it. But there was a lot of experimentation during the 1800s. I mean, the variety is the main thing. It's not to say that there weren't oranges like the oranges that we have now. It's more to say there were just more. There were more kinds, there were more types, there was more of a variety of flavors, textures, tastes, profiles, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. More of them had seeds, I know that. Today, seeds are not so much something that you want in an orange, so that's kind of been bred out. But there were more seeds back then, if you want to talk about a by and large situation, what is different? Mm-hmm. Taste-wise, just a variety. There were sour oranges, there were bitter oranges, there were blood oranges. Everybody was growing everything, every type of variety of orange that you can think of in the 1800s, somewhere in the state, somebody was trying to grow it, whether it could grow here well or not.
Yeah, that's sort of a similar story with apples. And you talk to people who are knowledgeable about historic apples, there used to be dozens, if not more, varieties, whereas big agriculture in the marketplace has essentially reduced that down to the handful of most popular. And you've got your Macintosh and your Granny Smith, but that full profile you talk about has essentially been removed from the apple market in favor of what can be produced on a mass scale cheaply for a global marketplace, essentially. Mm-hmm. It's interesting that the same thing, according to you, has largely happened to oranges.
And a lot of it's now grown on the sour orange rootstock, right? But they graft the other varieties onto that.
That's correct. Sour stock tends to be more hardy. Sweet stock is just more, it's just more wimpy. It just is.
It just tastes better, that's stock, all.
It tastes good, but any freeze that comes along, and sweet stock will just keel over and die. So you want your roots to be the hardiest part, because if the roots die off, the whole thing dies off. They graft onto the hardier stuff.
How many varieties then of oranges are popularly grown in Florida? Forget the one-offs and the craft growers, essentially. How many orange varieties are popularized by the citrus industry in Florida?
One.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
There are, honeybells, there are Valencias, there are, but if it comes right down to it, if you're talking about sheer volume, Valencia is the orange. I mean, yes, you have your boutique stuff, you have your orange box stuff, but the problem is, if you're talking about per volume type of deal, Valencias are what's grown, because that's what gets you orange juice.
I was just going to say that must be where orange juice comes from.
Yeah. Yeah. You're going to find other varieties that are grown, but it's just not, it's not even on the scale, like it's compared, but those things are getting more popular. The box kind of oranges that used to be popular before orange juice took over everything, because they're a little more resistant to citrus greening, it turns out.
We'll get to citrus greening, but just as far as the industry goes, is orange juice the primary use of the orange crop?
Absolutely. We have not been as successful in the past few years at marketing our oranges as whole oranges as California has been, even though most of what they're selling in the supermarket isn't scientifically an orange. To a consumer, it looks like an orange, tastes like an orange. It's an orange.
Are those the mandarins or the cuties?
Yeah. Those aren't oranges, but they are to a consumer, and they taste like oranges. So they might as well be, but any botanist listening to this is going to be mad at me if I say they are.
But my wife loves eating those things. They're smaller, they're easier to peel. And, from a just a market-driven standpoint, she would no more buy a big orange than, just get a watermelon for personal consumption. But she loves the cuties and has like two with breakfast.
I was going to ask you before we get more into the modern era, two very different women in the history of citrus. The first one is the author of Uncle Tom's Cabin, Harriet Beecher Stowe, and her role. Tell us about how she fits into the history of citrus in Florida.
She's kind of an odd one, because everybody thinks they know about her already. Well, most people think they know about her already, because she gets one or two lines in every textbook. And it's Harriet Beecher Stowe wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin, which made people realize maybe slavery was bad. And that's all she gets. But what they don't realize is that she was like Kardashian level popular. She was a mega celebrity of the time. She came to Mandarin, Florida, and she had her own little orange grove. And it wasn't her orange grove that was so impressive. It was her promotion of Florida, her promotion of growing oranges. So we all know Uncle Tom's Cabin, but we might not know Palmetto Leaves, which was her book all about how awesome Florida was. Everybody from up north, come down, grow your oranges. Yay. But she wrote so many articles, so many on Florida, on growing oranges, on how much money you could make. That it's actually kind of crazy. But she was enough of a celebrity that like steamboats would come by her house and they would let people off and they would invade her yard and like cut off pieces of orange tree and then leave, which she didn't like, which her husband didn't like. Nobody likes that. And she eventually worked out a deal with all the steamboat companies, and they even held barbecues at her house because she had to organize it in some way. Otherwise she'd just be overrun. In the book, I talk about how a paper in New York sent a guy down to find out about her house, to find out exactly how they decorated, exactly what they did, down to what they plastered the walls with behind the wallpaper.
I mean, sounds like he came in with a tape measure.
Yeah. So she said in at one point that she was joking, of course. She had a great sense of humor. We used to just carry his article around in our pockets, and whenever we wanted to know about, you know, how long a wall was, or you know, some aspect of our house, we would just open up the article, and there it'd be.
The other woman I was going to ask you about was Marjorie Kinnan Rawlings, the writer.
Yeah.
Where does she fit into the whole history?
Like Harriet Beecher Stowe, she had less of an impact on the actual industry and more of an impact on promotion of that industry and really promotion of Florida as its own character. She's interesting. She never really made that much money off the oranges. But she made a lot of money off of the orange culture, if that makes any sense. Her books about Florida orange growing, about Florida living, they made her, you know, a lot of money. Of course, she's famous for the yearling. But she wrote other things, too. She did profit off of how awesome Florida is. That's just like Harriet Beecher Stowe. I hadn't really thought of them in parallel before, but since he brought them up together, they have some real similarities as to what they did. They sort of shone a light on Florida and Florida growing. And she was really valuable to me because she had a detailed account of, as a small grower, what she did during the growing season, who she hired, how it worked, you know, what she gave them. And the workers and everything. And so that was really intensely interesting to me. It's something that Stowe didn't really get into.
Now, Rawlings, she hired, correct me if I'm wrong, she hired some black workers to pick her oranges, did she not?
Yes. And she treated them very, very well. One of the things that really struck me when I was reading her stuff, because I had context, was how lighthearted she was about the fact that she was quite literally really being threatened. In her books, she's so light about it, but I know it's like historically, I knew what was actually going on at that time.
Mention about what happened in Sanford with where the owner of the grove hired black workers and the white workers didn't like it.
Throughout citrus history, there's a lot of, I guess, interference from the KKK. I don't really know any other way to describe it.
Good way to put it.
Interference. An interruption of black labor from the KKK. It's a sad thing to have in our history, but it does exist. And, you know, we shouldn't ignore that it's there. She's lightheartedly writing about how she goes to town and she's being told by different people, you better hire white people because this is a depression and white people need money. And we hear you that you're paying the black people pretty well. And we think it would be better for you if you would hire. And she's just writing about it like it's just like everything's fine and oh, it's so funny. And then I did hire a white person and it didn't work out. But you were asking about Sanford. That was quite a bit earlier. Sanford was 1800s we're talking. So yeah, that was quite a bit early. Yeah, the KKK just had a fun history of continually doing that. Basically, they hired black workers because they showed up on time. But the crackers there did not. So they hired what they called Florida crackers, but they didn't like being told what to do. They didn't like the idea of being sort of beholden to anybody. Their idea of life is that they were free to work for a little bit and then, you know, skeeve off and do whatever it is they wanted to do. And so that doesn't make for very good workers.
No, not dependable anyway. Yeah.
Not dependable. So they went ahead and they started hiring Black workers, which the Black workers that they hired, those anyway, were very hungry for the opportunity and wanted to earn money. And they could hire them at a lower rate too. So, I mean, as a company, you're like, oh, we have more reliable workers that we can pay more cheaply. Well, that's what we want to do. But then the KKK got mad. The KKK got mad and started threatening them. And they had to import Swedish workers from that's Sweden, amazing. Like the poorest people you could possibly imagine. They didn't even have shoes when they came over. Basically to make the KKK happy, because they did stuff like burning down a mill and threatening people. And even the local sheriff was one of the KKK members. Of course, you know, you have a mask on over your face. Nobody can tell who you are. So they were going to report it to the local authorities, but they were the local authorities. So they had to talk to the U.S. Marshals. It was a very strange time.
And then the experiment with the Swedes, importing the Swedes, that didn't work out either, right?
Well, no. Sweden is cold. Sweden is cold. You have people that are acclimated to pretty cold weather. And all of a sudden, you ship them to Florida and you say, okay, go out there in the sun and work really hard. Have a good time. Oh, you don't have shoes. Oh, well, maybe we'll provide you with shoes just so you don't die, you know.
Just the fair skin alone, the fair hair to go out. And I'm at this point, I'm sure 10, 12, 14 hour work days, not uncommon in the sun straight from Scandinavia without your copper tone SPF 50. I mean, it's asinine.
But the feeling was workers are workers and it doesn't matter.
Yeah. The deals they had with them were a little bit exploitative, I would say, but that's the way things were. You would exploit the people who worked for you just as much as you possibly could, but make it as good of a deal for them as you could while it's still being a great deal for you.
At what point did obviously after the 1800s, I guess in the mid 1900s, they started experimenting with concentrate. How did that get started?
It actually started in the, I think it was because of the World War. So it was kind of commissioned because they're trying to get vitamin C into troops. You don't want scurvy. They had some really, really terrible stuff that they gave the troops in World War II that nobody liked. It was crystals that they would put in and then you'd, you know, pour in water and nobody liked it. It was not delicious. And that was one of the things that they said, oh my gosh, so we have this great delivery system to give our troops vitamin C, but they all hate it. So there's no point in putting it in the ration packs because no one will drink it. And so they, you know, approached the citrus industry and basically said, hey, figure something out for us, would you? something good that keeps. And they did. The thing is, it was 1945 and the war was over. What happened is they now had a really awesome product. But then they also had a whole generation of people that were like, oh, concentrated citrus? That sounds terrible. I was in the war. Yeah. So they had a real marketing problem. And I mean, there were people selling concentrate out of, you know, in companies like Minute Maid and stuff out of their car trunks, basically, to convince people that, hey, you know, concentrate is delicious. And, you know, it was.
Mm-hmm. They ended up having to get a celebrity spokesman, right?
Oh, Bing Crosby. Yes.
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 The old bingo.
Yes, yes. And of course, everything was settled over golf because that's Bing Crosby for you.
And concentrate became so big. I love this anecdote that you tell in there about John McPhee when he was working on his book about oranges, how he looked for someplace that didn't have concentrate.
When you get all misty and nostalgic, you think back to like the 1960s and you're like, oranges were everywhere. And you think, oh, there was fresh orange juice. Ooh. But it's really not true. Concentrate was king. I mean, it just took over everything. And yeah, in McPhee's book, he talks about how there were people who had an orange in their backyard that paid for concentrate at the grocery store. they could have gone to their backyard and they could have, you know, squeezed themselves
fruit off the tree. Yeah.
Yeah.
But they were buying.
They didn't do it. And they didn't really think about it until he said, well, you know, where can I get a fresh glass of orange juice? And then they just slowly came to the realization that, oh my gosh, we have an orange tree. And all we're drinking is concentrate. Yeah.
When would you say was the height of the citrus industry in Florida, and how would you characterize its importance and impact to Florida's economy?
The importance and impact, we'll just get that out of the way. It's almost incalculable, especially in the early development of our state. There isn't really a number. I mean, there's a year by year number, you know, however many millions of dollars, but cumulatively, it's hard for me to even fathom. Even if I put a number on it, you wouldn't be able to. Economically, it's been a huge, huge thing for our state. It's not going away. It's not going away.
What year would the peak have been?
I would say in the 1960s, would early, maybe 60s, would be, for me, looking at the industry, kind of where it was going, 60s. I mean, the 70s were all right. And then the 80s got bad because of the freezes. Yeah, they were already, these people had already really started selling off in the 60s. So these major sort of orange barons sold off to giant companies, and they made literally millions of dollars selling off Orange Grove land because they got out at the top of the market. And so I would say the 1960s have to be when that is, because the 1950s and 60s is when some of the major players went, oh, I can cash out for a lot of money. And they were smart businessmen.
Yeah.
They could sell to Tropicana or sell to a big developer who wanted to bulldoze the orange trees and put houses in there.
That sort of dovetails into something I did want to know. Who owns the citrus industry now? I'm guessing it's not family farmers. I'm guessing it's not, you know, local people, Tropicana, Minute Maid. Who controls the citrus industry in Florida circa 2021?
You would actually be surprised.
I would be. Tell me.
Because there's a lot of family farmers.
Really?
It's a hybrid of what you're talking about. It's very, very strange. While we've got these major players that are buying orange juice, we've got a lot of small cooperatives that are selling to them. We've got a lot of small farmers. Well, small is relative. Because, you know, if you've got a lot of acres, you start to become like a major player in the industry. Mm-hmm. But you are selling to these giant, you know,
corp. Tropicana or something like that. Yeah.
Right. I mean, and there's like a blend that's coming out of your cooperative. And your cooperative is made up of a lot of different little farmers. Mm-hmm. They give it to the cooperative to process sometimes. Every single part of Florida, it's all different. It is difficult to make a blanket statement about the way Florida oranges are processed and done, because it kind of is different in different places. But they're all answerable to these large corporations that are using, so they adhere to those standards. But you would be surprised at how many family farmers there are.
You mentioned about Bing Crosby. Let me ask you about the most notorious Florida citrus spokesperson, Anita Bryant.
Oh, no.
Stormy tenure.
A lot of young people have no idea who she is.
Right.
And before I researched this book, I didn't understand the punchline in Airplane about her, basically. I did not understand it. I didn't know who the heck she was. And then I started watching videos of interviews of her. I started sort of really diving into who she was. And
commercials were very effective. You know, her singing, "Come to the Florida Sunshine Tree." You know,
yes, just... yes. For those who don't know who she is, she started out as a beauty queen and a singer who basically covered standards, covered songs, a sort of America's sweetheart type of person, who was then later hired by the citrus industry to sing that song you just sang. Usually, I think with a cartoon bird. I think it was like the Florida orange bird, which you can actually buy mugs at Disney now with the Florida orange bird on it. But yes, so she was sort of a spokesperson for the Florida citrus industry, and she was very politically conservative, but they didn't know that until well after she was representing them for a very, very long time. And she was in Miami, and Miami at the time in the 1970s was passing some legislation, which is sort of the human rights ordinances that you're seeing pop up nowadays. Well, yeah. They didn't just pop up nowadays. They popped up in the 1970s. In Miami in particular, you had a lot of transplants from up north. So politically, they leaned a bit more liberal. And so they were looking to pass a human rights ordinance, which basically pretty much states it's not just race or religion that you can't fire somebody for. It's also sexual orientation. So she did not like that. And she started like Save Our Children, I think it was called.
That's what it's called.
Yeah, Save Our Children. And
she most claimed of homosexuals are going to recruit your kids.
Right. Most of what she said was, oh my gosh, isn't it terrible that there are gay people? They might be in your schools. They might be teaching your children. And because, and she literally said this, this was like, I watched this interview. It was of her, like, I didn't get the quote from somewhere else. I watched an interview of her where she said, gay people don't reproduce, so they have to recruit. She really started pushing that agenda pretty hard. The citrus industry ended up firing her, not because they didn't like her views, but because now she was associated with people thinking about gay people. That was like the weirdest thing to me is well, that.
And there was a boycott too, right?
There was a boycott. It was actually pretty wonderful. So Harvey Milk actually wrote about her in California. He wrote an article about her and asked people to boycott Florida citrus. So the citrus industry didn't like that either. And this was in California. I mean, they've got plenty of citrus there. They really don't need our oranges anyway. So they basically, it started with the drag bars and gay bars in San Fran, and they stopped mixing drinks with Florida orange juice. And then a lot of the straight bars, the regular everyday bars, they joined in too. And I think at like 10 a.m. one morning, you could smell the oranges in the streets. In the bar district down there, because everybody agreed to come out and pour out what they had left of all their Florida orange juice from their bars. So they all in that bar district.
So she was like the Bull Connor of the gay rights movement, in effect.
You know, they rallied around the fact that she was just so terrible. You know, there were t-shirts made, squeeze Anita, and different things. And, you know, mostly people knew her as being like kind of insufferable and intolerant. She got pied in the face. That was an interesting video to watch.
Oh, yeah.
Never see something. It was kind of mean, but I was also like, well, okay, I understand.
It's a sort of a nonviolent reaction. But then it turned out she was like this, you know, Miss Family Values lady, who then it turned out she was cheating on her husband and he was cheating on her, and they got divorced.
I got kind of sad for her because she was in this sort of trapped, mm-hmm. because the only way she could make money at one point was to be at these super, super hyper conservative churches and sing. And then when she got divorced from her husband, I mean, that was a pretty unhappy marriage. As soon as she got divorced from her husband, oh, well, you're not Family Values. And those people just sort of,
they turned on her too. If you dig into it far enough, one of her lieutenants in that campaign was Jerry Falwell. And that's sort of where he got the idea for his organization. Anyway, so what's the state of the industry nowadays? Let me jump forward dealing with greening.
It's not thriving, but it's certainly coming back from. We've been fighting it for quite a while. And the thing about when I was researching this book, one of the things that I tended to notice was there was a lot of sky is falling headlines every single time that I would take a look at, you know, newspaper clippings of different things that have happened to the citrus industry over the years. It would be like, this is the end. Oh no, everything is horrible and dark and doom and drear and oh my gosh, it's cold. And so now we will have no citrus industry in just a scant few years. It will all be gone. You know, oh no, there's fruit flies. And I mean, we're talking from like, you know, 1900 on, you know, there was always some terrible crisis where, you know, somebody in a newspaper was saying, this is the end. Citrus greening, you know, I started out with the perception that, oh my gosh, this horrible thing is happening to our state, and this is the end for oranges in Florida. And I thought to myself, oh my gosh, I remember all those groves that got abandoned during the freezes, and now this. Oh, yeah. But then I, you know, started to realize that these crises, there are crises that happen. And yes, they are something that you should be alert about. And they are something you should adjust for. You shouldn't do nothing. But it doesn't mean the end. It just means adjustment.
What is citrus greening?
It's basically a bacteria that's spread by a bug. A very, very tiny bug that loves citrus trees, basically, ciliate. And that's all it is. This bacteria gets inside the tree. And then think of it as plaque clogging your arteries. Mm. So trees have what amounts to arteries. Mm-hmm. It arteries that take up water and nutrients up to the top of the tree. And it feeds the leaves, and it feeds the fruit. And when you have this bacteria in the tree, it starts to clog up those arteries. So it starts out, you know, your fruit has a little less good quality. Eventually, it's terribly bitter. There's no way to sell it. It's really, really horrible. There's no saving it, really. That's what it is. It clogs up the tree. And eventually, the tree dies. But before that, well, you have a tree that has terrible fruit. Yeah.
Where does the bug that spreads the bacteria come from?
Everywhere. I mean, it's a bug that if you have citrus, it comes from everywhere. There's no particular place
it's from Asia originally, right? It's an exotic.
Well, citrus greening is from Asia. Yes.
Oh, okay.
Well, citrus greening is the first place they noticed it anyway, because like a lot of other things. That was one of the problems with citrus greening is that there are so many other things that kind of mimic the symptoms that look like citrus greening. So you could be treating your tree for other things, and it might even work temporarily, some of the treatments. But, you know, in the end, your tree is going to die, but you might not even know what it is.
Mm-hmm. Well, why wasn't there citrus greening then in the 70s, 80s if this bug has always been around?
The bug has always been around, but not the bacteria.
So where did the bacteria come from then, I guess?
Other populations of bugs from Asia.
Yeah.
Probably. It's possible that it was around back then. It's just that there wasn't a lot of it. Wasn't a lot of it, and they were doing other things. It's hard to say. I think it by and large came from Asia.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we talk so much on this podcast, Craig, about invasive species, you know, invasive pythons, invasive
right. iguanas,
lionfish. There's all kind, you know, Brazilian pepper, you know, kudzu, whatever. We talk a lot about, you know, invasive plants, invasive animals, but there's also invasive bugs, invasive bacteria. And that this impact on the economy is why Florida has to be so ever vigilant and spend so much money about invasive species, because they can destroy
everything.
Yeah, there you go. Everything. Yeah, sure.
All right. No, let me ask you the most controversial question of all. Which do you prefer, pulp or no pulp in your orange juice?
That is a terrible question, because it depends on the mood that I'm in.
Oh.
Like, yeah, I will go either way on the pulp or no pulp. Sometimes I just want a clear, beautiful glass of orange juice. Sometimes I want to chew it a little.
Last one for me. Has climate change started to make any impact on the citrus industry here?
Oh, for sure. One of the things that happened with the freezes is that we inched down the state. Our citrus groves, the ones that are producing the most in volume and everything, they're now in the southwest of our state. That wasn't always true. And these days, we aren't going back up the state, even though things have been considerably warmer, but we are seeing Georgia coming here and asking for help with citrus, asking us for advice. We have the Carolinas coming down and asking us for advice. The research center here in Florida, they're seeing people from states further north coming down here and basically saying, okay, we've had oranges for a little while, we're going to expand. And they go, what? And we're also seeing some of the panhandle. I've also seen a little bit of an expansion in the panhandle. We're having more storms and stuff like that.
Yeah.
That's another thing. So places that don't normally get hit real hard with hurricanes, like I think 2017 was one where they got hit with hurricanes. Storms and cold are the two things that any citrus grower fears. Well, there's plenty of other things to fear, but you're talking about the weather.
Yeah.
It's storms and cold. And down south, it's always storms. And up north, it's always cold. And there really isn't a heck of a lot you can do to stop a storm from messing up an orange grove. So I'm interested to see if new weather patterns kind of arise, if it's going to make things, you know, all those people that came down south to escape the cold, they might be making some moves back up to old land.
What about water use? Has the orange industry done better than some elements of agriculture as far as conserving water, or are they kind of wasteful like a lot of the other farmers are?
Oranges take a lot of water. They take a lot of water and a constant drip of water. They take more water than a lot of other crops do on a more consistent and regular basis. I mean, has that industry done better than other industries? I don't know how to compare oranges to bell peppers when it comes to that. It's hard. It's very difficult for me to compare two different segments of agriculture as far as, you know, who's doing a better job. I know that oranges substantially take more than other crops, but they're trees and they're fruit. That's just the way it is. But I can say that consistently we have been trying to conserve water when it comes to orange growing for quite some time. And there's been some programs in the 1980s where they were trying to figure out ways to be as efficient as they possibly could in getting water where it needed to be, when it needed to be there. I know that it gets vilified because it does use so much, but a lot of these orange growers, particularly the ones that are generations of families that have done it, they think of themselves as stewards of the land. They don't want to use more.
Okay.
Aaron Thursby has been our guest. Florida Oranges, A Colorful History. If you can't find it at your local independent bookseller, it's everywhere online. Thank you so much for your insight today.
It's been so enlightening. Yeah.
Wonderful. Yeah. Wonderful job.
Let me tell you about my morning. So this morning, you know, I don't normally think about this stuff, but I did today because of who our guest was. This morning for breakfast, I had a blueberry muffin and an orange juice, simply orange, no pulp. And drank that down. And then as I was driving, I'm in Sarasota today visiting my father-in-law. And, you know, on the way, I passed by the gigantic Tropicana plant here on US 301 in Manatee County. And then I passed shortly after that big sign that said, citrus grower, come in and buy our citrus. Yeah. And and I thought, you know, it's still all around us. And in fact, I also, I didn't pass by it, but I knew it was there at the end of the Skyway. There's a place called the Citrus Place, and it's an old-fashioned Florida orange grove, and they sell, you know, not just Valencia but all the other different varieties, the honeybells and so forth. I would stop in there every now and then and buy a few different varieties for my wife, because how much she loves them, just like yours.
Absolutely. Well, there's, pardon the pun, there's a lot to unpeel with that episode. We won't all have the time now, but I'm glad you brought up Anita Bryant, a truly villainous character from Florida history, someone who I was introduced through your book, Oh Florida, who deserves her own episode. But, you know, Harriet Beecher Stowe to Marjorie Kinnon Roe, the Klan. I mean, this is real. You know, when we started this way, when you think about Florida, there's those four pillars, in my opinion: beaches, Disney, alligators, oranges. And we've done episodes on all the others. This sort of completes that that foreplay. And I could have gone on and on and on with Aaron.
Oh yeah. Well, and you know, you think the title of her book is a pun, but it's not. It really is A Colorful History. No. Welcome to Florida.
Welcome to Florida.